This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we are at SoFi Stadium in Inglewood, and no, we're not here to catch a game. That's over for now. We're actually, well, we're getting on an escalator, headed to take a tour of an art exhibition. The Kinsey African American Art and History Collection has toured 35 cities across America over the last 15 years. And now it's back here in LA, taking over the club level of this incredible new stadium. And Khalil Kinsey is the chief curator of the collection. He joins us here on this escalator to talk about it. Hey, Khalil.
Hey, Steve.
These things, this collection, it's the doing of your mom and dad, right, Bernard and Shirley?
It is. It is. It started some 50 plus years ago.
And we're headed to a suite.
Yeah, that's where we're going to start, in the suite.
We're going in a fancy suite right now.
Yeah, this was my office, actually. This is our office while we were installing the exhibition. So that was super cool.
I appreciate you being here. As chief curator of the collection, I want to talk a little bit about the history and how and why your parents started collecting this work.
Sure. This was catalyzed by a number of different things. I was born in 1977 when Alex Haley's Roots premiered.
I remember it well. That was a television event, man.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
A television event and a cultural phenomenon, you know, particularly for black folks. And my parents were amongst those who really absorbed that, and it prompted them to want to learn more and seek out more about their own heritage and lineage. And that coupled with my third grade family history report, that where you interview your relatives and you get your family history and trace the branches of your family tree. And did that, went back to school, and instantly realized that my story paled in comparison to that of my classmates. I could only go back about four generations, and my classmates could go back for centuries, some of them. And I remember to this day how that felt, how inadequate that I felt, and how many questions and the confusion. And I took that back home, and my parents didn't have many answers. And that really, they credit as being, you know, that tipping point that really pushed them to say, hey, we may not be able to totally collect and tell our full family story directly, but we can tell that of the black family. And, you know, all of those things kind of made this into what it is. But for my upbringing up until 2005, this was just in my parents' home. And it was a chance kind of thing where the LA Times wrote an article, "These Walls Do Talk" was the title, and museums started reaching out, starting with the California African American Museum, and we've been on this mission journey ever since.
Tell me a little bit about like your growing up experience, because you said all of these things, these artifacts, these, you know, paintings or whatever it may be, portraits,
sure,
were in the house.
Right. It was part of my parents', the fabric of our home. And we lived in a lot of homes when I was growing up, because my parents were also developing homes. And so I would start to see the evolution. They would work with the same architect each time. And the evolution of wall space and nooks and crannies and shelves and all of this designed to showcase the collection. I remember in the 90s, you know, after going away to college, every time I would come back, there would be something new that my father was showing me, and it may be the Dred Scott decision or a letter from Malcolm X.
How difficult was it to make this vision come to life, do you think? You know, I mean, a stadium is, it's not your typical art venue, right? So here you are, you're trying to present this not only, you know, to the community at large, but also inside a football stadium, which is not your regular place to do something like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. There's been a steep learning curve, I think, on both sides when it came to executing on this vision. We jumped to show the exhibition in places like this, because it's not simply about museums and institutions. It's about, you know, the places where these experiences are unexpected, you know, and meeting people where they are. And that's a huge part of our mission.
So speaking of football, let's take a look outside,
outside these doors.
All right, so here we are in the stands, right? But I want to ask you about this, because this is a juxtaposition for me. The NFL is what, 75-80% African American?
Right.
And you've got a collection going on inside the stadium that highlights the lives of the people who came before, the people who were making millions of dollars on this field,
right,
or
absolutely.
Maybe not millions of dollars, but
yeah, maybe not.
But I want you to, I mean, what is you as a black man? How does that prepare you for the things that you do?
What we do is about illuminating a fuller scope of blackness, right, and humanity at large, and really elevating our approach to how we see each other in terms of equality. And so that's something that we've had an opportunity to do in 36 exhibitions around the world, but this one is special because this is unexpected the way that people will come to see a football game. Perhaps seeing, you know, one or two pieces on the wall that speaks about something they didn't know about and shares the beauty of African-American life and contribution. Perhaps they'll look differently at the player on the field and see them as not just a player on the field.
Let's give some folks some due, shall
Let's
we?
Do it.
Let's look at some of this collection.
So I'm going to take you down. We're going to start down here just to give you a little more background.
Now, there is a lot going on.
This is level two. This is the club level. I bring you to this piece first because this is what has become our lead image and what we show everywhere. It says everything that we are striving to do with the collection.
I have a print of this, by the way.
Do you?
Yeah.
No way.
I framed it. I love just all of it, the bursting colors, all of it. It's just so, and it's abstract. I love it.
Right.
Yeah, this is Samuel Dunson. Yeah.
Samuel Dunson. In 1999, we were actually in Savannah, Georgia at the Savannah College of Art and Design. And we met my parents, as they often did. They asked, you know, to be pointed to some of the exciting, you know, black artists that were students there. And we were pointed to Samuel Dunson. We went to lunch and spent the better part of a day with him. And my parents commissioned him to do a piece of work. Then he came back with this piece. And he said after spending time with us, he was compelled to paint us as cultivators of knowledge. It's called The Cultivators. We are in a field of books. My father is gathering them. My mother is cleaning them. And I'm in the back reading one. And that's by my namesake, Khalil Gibran. That's the prophet.
I had no idea this was your family.
Yes, yeah. So, you know, this was 5 or 6 years before we embarked on this journey of being a public exhibition. So this is like was foreshadowing, was prophetic that this young man saw us in this way. You know, and so we honor him. He's a professor at Tennessee State University now, but this is our way of honoring him, but also truly centering the work that we do when it comes to discovery and sharing information. This is an area called that we call the Roots of Genius, starting with a 1773 first edition book by Phyllis Wheatley, Poems on Various Subjects, Religious and Moral. This is the first book of poetry written and published by an African-American in the United States, the second ever by an African-American. And she was 13 when she started writing this book, but we call her a genius because she was. She arrived at 5 years old on a slave ship called Phyllis. She was purchased by the Wheatley family. That's how she got her name, Phyllis Wheatley. That's a pretty crazy way to get your name. She doesn't speak any English when she arrives.
She's from Gambia.
She's from Gambia, exactly. Yeah. And within a matter of a couple years, she's speaking fluent English, Latin, and Greek. She is a brilliant pianist and violinist. And then at 13, she begins writing the first book of poetry that later she is able to publish at the age of 17.
But in the minds of early America, she's a slave.
She's absolutely a slave through and through, so much so that she was denied the right to publish the book in the Americas. She had the family, while slave owners, they obviously understood her brilliance, and they arranged for her to go to England to publish this book. So this is the final section until we open the contemporary component, which will extend into this area here.
And this is the future.
This is the future. This is, well, the Kinsey Collection really is a modern art collection as far as where we, you know, what my parents' focus was. And, you know, part of my role is to be a bridge and to continue to carry this forward in practice. So, you know, when the opportunity to highlight and support young artists is something that, you know, I really love to do. So we're going to be doing that here in the exhibition, but also bringing the collection forward as far as who we're supporting and bringing in and sharing through the lens of history and culture.
Khalil Kinsey, CLO, Chief Curator of the Kinsey Collection. Khalil, Thanks for helping us along this journey.
Man, it's truly my pleasure. My pleasure and honor. Thank you for sharing the journey, and thank you for sharing the story.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA from KCRW. Steve Chiatakis here. If you have ever picked up a doughy treat from a mom-and-pop donut shop in LA, there's a good chance the owner of that shop, or their parents or grandparents, built a brand new life in the United States after fleeing war and genocide in Southeast Asia. Not kidding. Marketplace, the public radio business program, it ran an analysis back in the late 1990s that showed about 80% of the donut shops in California were owned by Cambodian Americans, many of them refugees. Now enter the Donut Kids, which is the second and third generation of children of those refugees who grew up in and around these donut shops. Well, those Donut Kids are the subject of a new exhibition called Donut Hole by Angeleno artist Fung Nguyen, and she joins us right now. Welcome to Greater LA, Fung.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me here today.
Before we get into all of the, you know, the minutiae of your art and how just unique it is, why donuts? What was the allure of donuts for Cambodian immigrants to this country?
I think like many different things, like nail salon shops for Vietnamese, once one successful refugee or immigrant who comes here, it kind of permeates with other immigrants and community helping each other. So the legend is that Ted Ngoy, a Cambodian refugee, came to Tustin to Southern California in 1975, and he worked as a janitor in a church during the day, and at night he worked at a gas station, and a coworker gave him a donut, and he took a bite, never had a donut before, and was just, you know, what is this? This is delicious, right? And brought it home to his family, and they all loved this surprise and this novelty for them. And he had the idea of like, I want a donut shop. I want to do that. That's what I want to do. The long and short of it is that he ended up saving money and buying a donut shop. And as more Cambodian refugees were coming to the Southern California area, they were looking for other Cambodians. And he gave them jobs and acquired more donut shops and leased them and gave jobs. And that's how it all started. And that's the connection between Cambodian immigrants and refugees and the donut.
And Ngoy is also he was the creator of the pink donut boxes, right?
That's correct. Yeah. That's another legend that he or a worker wanted to save money on boxes. And the worker called a box distributor and asked for cheaper cardboard. And they had all this excess pink cardboard and offered to the pink cardboard to them. And that's the ubiquitous like pink donut box.
The pink donut boxes, which of course you put your artwork on. It's an example of exactly how important the donut making and the donut distributing are to the Cambodian American community. So you created portraits of these donut kids, second and third generation Cambodian Americans, many of whom children of refugees. Tell us about how you came to this idea.
Well, before the second and third generation, I started with the first generation. I started with the refugees and immigrants themselves who had to flee genocide. Steve, my father is a genocide survivor. He was born in Cambodia, and in 1975, on a bike with falsified documents, biked his way to Vietnam, the neighboring country, where he met my mom. And
wow.
So my mom and I were both born in Vietnam. So my family history is rooted in the Southeast Asian refugee experience, both from Cambodia and from Vietnam.
It's an all too familiar story, isn't it? And a horrific story, yeah.
And very pertinent today with what's going on in Ukraine and our Afghanistan brothers and sisters and Haitian brothers and sisters as well. So we resettled in the United States in 1978, and I knew for a very long time that I wanted to pass on these stories to my children or make art about it, but it didn't occur until now in my 40s, given time to process how to respectfully and honor the story. And it happened with, yeah, you know, there's something that's so ubiquitous and something so common growing up with family members and community folks, very common having friends and cousins working in donut shops or owning. I'm like, wait, this is our story. This thing that seems so normal and everyday to us is our story. And I want to capture their story and I want to make their portraits and draw them. So I began with my parents and immediate family of folks in my community who were Vietnamese and Cambodian refugees and drew them first.
On the pink boxes.
On the pink boxes themselves. And that led to thinking about future generations. You know, I'm a mom, Steve, so thinking of the second and third generation and cultural erasure and assimilation and that intergenerational relationship led me to thinking about the kids who grew up, who were born here, but like grew up having to go to the donut shop after school and helping out their parents.
Let's talk about how you do that, because you print the drawings of these young adults over the photos of them as children, right? So it's sort of I guess you're identifying them as sort of moving in time.
Yes, and connecting with that history, who they are now and where their roots are. So I interviewed these donut kids and I asked them to give me photographs of them as children when they were at the donut shop, like Andrew Hang when he was playing Legos at the donut shop after school as a kid, you know? Or them as 7 and 8 year olds posing in front of the case of donuts. And so I asked them for these childhood photographs and retreated them on the computer and pixelated them and you know, gave them this sort of pink veneer. And on top, I made drawings of them now, their portraits of them now, to kind of have this relationship of the then and now and how they're forging their new identities with this very complicated past.
In another piece of the exhibit, you capture a quintessential image to a lot of Angelenos, which is Randy's Donut Shop. This is the big donut sign, right? The original one.
Yeah.
The original one that's not too far off the freeway, off the 405. In the corner, it says "Made by Refugees." What inspired that piece?
You know, growing up in Los Angeles, we would go to the airport and pick up family members, people coming from out of town or out of the country. And I would always see the giant Randy's Donut. For me, growing up in the 80s and 90s, that Randy's Donut was a landmark of Los Angeles and of Inglewood, you know. And I always thought, is it real? Like, can I take a bite out of it? But I feel like, you know, juxtaposing something like Randy's or even say Winchell's or like large chain donuts with Made by Refugees, which is painted in pink in the font that reminds us of, say, Dunkin' Donuts font or Fortune Cookie pink font, to remind us that LA is a host to a rich, diverse place of immigrants and refugees who really built our economy here, but not without acknowledging, of course, that it's built on Tongva land. But I wanted to contrast, like, you know, the big commercial donuts versus like these mom and pop donuts, acknowledging like immigrant and refugee labor in Los Angeles.
A lot of symbolism in your work. Artist Phuong Huynh, I want to thank you for your time. Phuong, thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Steve.
And by the way, you can check out Phuong's solo exhibition, Donut Hole, at Self-Help Graphics and Art Gallery in Boyle Heights. It is free. You can visit Tuesday through Friday until May 27th. Onward now with KCRW's Greater LA and on to another exhibition, which takes us to the Mojave Desert, literally. It is called The High Desert Test Sites by Annie Ull. It explores the space between Vegas and Los Angeles, also known as the desert. There are 9 different installations, all from different artists, plopped in the middle of the Mojave, in the dirt and sand. And to tell us more, our art insider Lindsay Preston-Zappas is here. She's the founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Hey, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
So, all right, we know where the show is. What is this show?
Yeah, so High Desert Test Sites is a nonprofit organization, and they create exhibitions and programming in the desert. And they put on this biennial exhibition where like you said, they commission artists to create site-specific artworks and installations that are sited in the kind of middle of nowhere, it feels like. So, you know, this iteration includes 9 artists, and their pieces are installed all across the high desert region. So there's some in Joshua Tree, Yucca Valley, Wonder Valley, 29 Palms. Some of the sites have, you know, like 50 miles between them. So it's a really large area of the desert that these are installed within. And, you know, it's a really different experience than seeing an artwork in a museum or gallery space. Some of the pieces are sculptural works that are really massive in scale. Jack Pearson has a text piece that says "the end of the world" in really massive wooden lettering. And there are actually a couple of video pieces. So for one of the videos, they created a screening room in the middle of the desert landscape, which is a bit unlikely. So again, the projects are really ambitious in scale, and it's really exciting to see them so integrated within the landscape.
I mean, when you're driving through there on I-15, right, between Vegas and L.A., you're talking about a very vast landscape,
yeah.
Right? It looks kind of like the end of the world. there are 9 artists, as you mentioned, 9 installations, some of them big, others not so big. I mean, was there anything that stood out to you?
Yeah. So Gerald Clark is an indigenous Kaweah artist, and he created an installation sort of near Yucca Valley on BLM land on what used to be the Sunfair Dry Lake Bed, which is now totally dry. And his artwork is called Earth Memory. And his piece has hundreds of these white flags on these flagpoles. And each flag was printed with a different prehistoric fish that used to actually swim in the lake and kind of be in the area, which is now all dried up. And he worked with school children to actually decorate these flags. So, you know, as you probably know, the desert gets quite windy. So as the wind kind of pipes through, the tails on the flags look like they're swimming. So it really looks like a school of fish kind of swimming through the desert. And the artist also performed some indigenous songs last weekend for the opening. So here he is singing a Kaweah fish song.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's really cool.
Beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so another really great work is by the artist Rachel Whitereed, and she made these concrete casts of these abandoned homestead cabins. So these ones are actually going to be permanent installations even after the biennial closes, and they're cabin-sized sculptures made of concrete. So literally, she casts the inside of these cabins kind of using the walls of these structures as molds, and then the walls are removed. So what you see is almost like an inside-out cast of these structures. So you see all these details like the windows, the outlets in the wall, and they become these really kind of minimal monuments that are sited within the middle of the desert and these Joshua trees. So, you know, thinking about this exhibition and the title is The Searchers, there's really this kind of longer history of the area and its inhabitants that the artworks really kind of key into.
Underscoring the 9, as we talked about, 9 different installations from 9 artists. I mean, it seems like there's some work involved in this. You have to go from place to place, right?
Yeah, it's not super easy. You know, it's definitely a scavenger hunt to find these artworks. It's wild, you know, to be out in the desert. I went over this last weekend and it was hot. It was hot here in LA too, but it was hot in the desert. And you really have to contend with the elements. You know, you're kind of driving around looking for these artworks. You have a map, but, you know, it's a little unclear. A lot of the works, you're driving on dirt roads. I actually got stuck with my husband at one point. We had to kind of like dig our tire out. You know, so like sunscreen, water, hats, these all become really essential elements for this art viewing experience. So it's definitely specific. But I think that's part of what makes it so unique, you know, is this kind of relationship that the artwork has to the land and environment. It all really feeds into the experience and kind of the curatorial vision of these artworks that are so integrated with the landscape.
We look at it as sort of the space between LA and Vegas, right? But there are so many people who live there and it's their home,
yeah.
And they're right. And so I wonder, I mean, like before you head out there, is it a day trip? Can you do this in a day? Or, I mean, if you're in LA, how do you get this done?
Yeah, I think a day trip would be very ambitious. I looked at all 9 sites over 2 days, and it was full days, you know, because you're driving around between them. So definitely it's a trip that you want to kind of prepare for before you go. Go on the website, highdeserttestsites.com. They have a list of all the artworks as well as kind of maps and driving directions to get to each sites. But you definitely, again, want to think about things like hats and water and maps and get that all kind of ready before you go. And the exhibition is up for a little longer than another month until May 22nd.
Lindsay Preston Zappas, founder and editor in chief of Contemporary Art Review LA. Lindsay, as always, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow in this slot, well, we're going to take a day off, but we'd love for you to check out an important statewide public radio special called Climate Costs. Climate change is remaking life as we know it in California. This hour-long special looks at how it's affecting everything from the strawberry fields near the coast, up near Oxnard, to riverbeds, to the desert, of course, to thermometers and rain gauges everywhere. Climate Costs from the California Newsroom Collaboration tomorrow in this slot right here on KCRW. Join us online, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Hear any story from this program. Share your comments with us. Of course, subscribe to the podcast too, kcrw.com/GLA. Jenna Cagle, Andrea Bautista, Rebecca Ludman, Robin Estrin, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all helped assemble this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears tonight. Have a great night.